Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. For the rest of the hour today, we're looking back on a conversation we had with Dr. Gregory Erickson. He's a professor of biological science at Florida State University. His study of fossilized dinosaur eggs found that dinosaurs are not as much like birds as many people seem to think, because it took far longer for the eggs to hatch than for birds. Let's hear that story now. Dr. Erickson, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment about recent discoveries about dinosaurs, give us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. Dr. Erickson, I have to say in the first paragraph, I stumbled over the reference to birds because you called them living dinosaurs. For those who haven't followed the latest developments in paleontology, where does that come from?
Well, over the years, we've learned that dinosaurs basically didn't go extinct. The lineage of basically the raptors from Jurassic Park, that lineage gave rise to modern birds.
So in your study, which was released in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, you made a lot of findings that don't seem to mesh with the idea that dinosaurs are birds. Well, birds are dinosaurs, but dinosaurs are not birds. Can you tell me a bit about those findings?
Yeah, well, I've said that before. What I'm trying to say is that what we look at as a bird is biologically not identical to what the dinosaurs were like. One assumption that was made for the last 20 years or so, we just assumed that dinosaurs had very rapid incubation simply because birds are dinosaurs, whereas reptiles have very slow incubation. It takes about twice as long for the eggs to hatch out. And so basically we're able to crack the code and figure out that the dinosaurs actually had slow incubation, like reptiles such as crocodiles and lizards and animals like that. So in that sense, dinosaurs, what we call non-avian dinosaurs, the non-birds, basically had a biology that was a bit different than what we see in the dinosaurs today, the birds.
Maybe more similar than to reptiles.
Yes.
So, and you figured this out by studying the development of the teeth in the embryo.
Yeah, what we did is there are growth lines as a tooth forms. So it's basically as a tooth forms, it fills in with a tissue called dentine. It's the core of our teeth. And each day, some dentine is laid down in liquid form, and then it mineralizes, and it leaves a very distinctive ring called an incremental line of von Ebner. And by simply counting up the number of those rings, just like counting rings on a tree, you can figure out how long it took the tooth to form. So we extracted some teeth from embryos. These are dinosaur eggs that have an embryonic skeleton in them. They were just about to hatch out. We sectioned the teeth and made microscope slides, counted up the growth lines, and lo and behold, we figured out how long they were in the egg.
So you know how long it takes for that liquid dentine to become mineralized? So that was how you were able to track that?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in humans, it's been well established that the dentine's laid down on a daily basis and leaves these very distinctive lines. And in my master's research, which I did 25 years ago at Montana State University, I discovered daily growth lines in dinosaur teeth. And to confirm that they were daily in dinosaurs, I studied crocodilians, which are very close relatives of dinosaurs. And we chemically labeled alligators and basically were able to show that these rings form in reptiles on a daily basis as well.
Well, so I was reading this study and I found it really interesting that they had functional and then replacement teeth. Did they have baby teeth like we do?
Well, actually, dinosaurs were polyphyodont. And what I mean by that is they basically produce teeth and shed them throughout life. So some of these duck-billed dinosaurs, the larger dinosaur we studied, had over 1,000 teeth, believe it or not. And they probably shed 3,000 or 4,000 teeth a year. They basically put the tooth fairy out of business back then. So yes, baby teeth in the sense that they had teeth that were older and younger, so to speak, but it was just a conveyor belt of teeth, kind of like a shark.
Mm-hmm. So, but birds, do they have teeth? Is there a piranha bird?
No, birds don't have teeth today. Although, if you look at the embryology of teeth, they start forming teeth. They just don't mineralize. That's been shown in chickens. But the earliest birds did have teeth. So about 150 million years ago, an animal named Archaeopteryx evolved, and this was the first bird, and it still had teeth. So it was kind of like a feathered dinosaur, so to speak. And birds retained teeth for tens of millions of years, and then just before the dinosaurs went extinct, the birds basically lost their teeth and basically went to beaks. And those are the animals that actually survived the KPG cataclysm, which is when this asteroid hit the planet about 65.5 million years ago.
And then also the discovery that their eggs take so long to hatch, or so much longer to hatch, I don't think that was very helpful in their drive to try to survive that cataclysmic event.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest ramification of our finding that dinosaurs took between 3 and 6 months to incubate their eggs. This is basically twice as long as what a bird does. And so we think this finding, coupled with several others, basically gives us an important piece of the puzzle as to figuring out why dinosaurs went extinct and animals such as the birds and the mammals and lizards and amphibians made it through. We liken it to dinosaurs finding themselves holding a dead man's hand, so to speak, black eights and aces. This asteroid hit the planet. Most flora was completely decimated, so there wasn't much to eat. And dinosaurs basically had some bad cards. And so one of those was that they were endothermic, so they were warm-blooded animals. And we've determined that from some of the growth curve work I've done on dinosaurs. So endotherms are warm-blooded animals such as ourselves profligate consumers of energy. It takes a lot of energy to grow up, and so a lot of the energy goes into just keeping our body temperature stable. And so dinosaurs appear to have been that way. And so even if a dinosaur survived this cataclysm, there wouldn't have been much to eat. And the next thing we look at is how long it takes these animals to regenerate. And what we found is that all dinosaurs took years to sexually mature. Even the smallest dinosaurs probably took over a year to sexually mature, so it's very, very. They were animals who were very slow at basically replacing themselves. And then you throw in this other black ace, and that's the fact that their incubation was also slow. So this would have made them have extremely slow generation times as well.
And well, so at least a year and a half, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we think this combination of attributes, really put them at in a bad corner, so to speak, trying to survive this, the conditions after this cataclysm.
I know it was 65 million years ago, but I kind of feel bad. I feel kind of sad for them. We are talking with paleobiologist Dr. Gregory Erickson. You can become part of the conversation, too, by giving us a call at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Can you tell me a little about these eggs? I can't imagine there are a whole lot of fossilized dinosaur eggs around. How were you able to get them?
That's a great question. So dinosaur eggs are actually really common.
They are.
Yes, they are. They had mineralized eggs, or calcified eggs, I should say, just like birds do. And so they were very easily fossilized. And we find pieces of dinosaur eggs all over the Badlands where we find dinosaurs. So we're in Mongolia or in Montana or Alberta, any of the places we find lots of dinosaurs. We find pieces of eggshell all over the place. Very rarely do we find whole eggs or a nest. And then even more rarely do we find an egg that actually has an embryo in it. Now, in the case of the eggs we studied, one of them was from Protoceratops. This is a little horned dinosaur from Mongolia, from the Gobi Desert, lived about 75 million years ago. And it had about a 200-gram egg, kind of looked like potatoes. And when those eggs were found by the American Museum in New York, they could see that there were bones sticking out of them. So they knew that the embryos were in there. And then the other eggs we looked at were from the other end of the spectrum of egg sizes. And that's a 4-kilogram egg for a dinosaur called Hippacrosaurus, which is a duck-billed dinosaur. And these eggs are ridiculous. They look like volleyballs. So they basically were the size of 4 ostrich eggs, if you can imagine. They make a hell of an omelet.
That's a big egg.
That's a big egg, yeah.
I'm thinking 4 kilograms. I'm trying to do the math in my head, and that's probably 9 pounds or so, 9.5, 10.
Yeah, it's up there.
Wow. That's a big egg. But, yeah. I mean, so you mentioned ostrich eggs. Do they have the same kind of long incubation time as dinosaurs, but because they're birds, they don't?
They have slow incubation. Yeah, did they?
Well, because
they're actually, yeah, they're big. Yeah, they, so basically, the way it works is the larger the egg, the longer the incubation period is. So ostrich eggs hatch out in about 42 days, and so for the giant Hippocrysaur eggs, we were getting 6 months, and for the much smaller Protoceratops eggs, they were hatching out in 3 months. So we think this bounds the range that dinosaur eggs were hatched over the time over which their eggs were hatched.
So that baby Protoceratops, when he hatched, how big would he be? Would he be like a foot tall?
No, it would have been – it was a very small animal. It would have maybe been a foot long and I don't know, maybe at best 5 or 6 inches tall.
Okay. Well, we have a phone call coming in from Micah in Naples. She has a question. Micah?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It was my first time calling in. Really enjoying the show.
Great. What would you like to ask?
My question is – now, forgive my ignorance on the subject, but you were describing why that dinosaurs would have had such a hard time surviving after the cataclysmic event. You listed several factors, some of which I imagine would include their size and how much energy it took to keep their bodies warm. Why is it that dinosaurs did not stick around, and that we do see large mammals such as like the elephant or I don't even know if the elephant was around during that time or its earliest ancestor? And I can take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you for calling. So I guess the question is, I don't think elephants were there, but I mean, there was the mammoth. I mean, and those things were able to how would you answer that?
Well, actually, in the age of dinosaurs, mammals were relegated to very small sizes. So they were kind of mouse to possum-sized animals. And they were a lot like mice and possums. They were basically insectivorous or omnivorous animals. And I think the gist of the question is why did those animals make it through? And so mammals have much more rapid generation times, even though they were warm-blooded even though mammals are warm-blooded creatures, they have very rapid generation times. You know, for instance, a large rat can regenerate itself in like 16 weeks, and so they can just repopulate the planet very quickly. And the more rapid an animal's generation times allows them basically to repopulate the planet, compete for resources, and also the more generation times you have, the more likelihood there's going to be mutation, which would allow them to evolve into vacated ecological niche space after this extinction. And on top of it, the mammals were small. They seemed to be even smaller than even the largest mammals were kind of borderline with the smallest dinosaurs. And so they had some advantage in the sense that they didn't need as much energy to reach sexual maturity.
So we had no mammoths back then. They did not happen until later.
If I found a mammoth back in the age of dinosaurs, I'd be very famous and we'd have to revisit evolution.
Well, I don't know. When you watch the movie Ice Age, they're right there. I know it's a cartoon. I'm sorry. I wonder how much these movies drive you crazy with the inaccuracies. Do you watch these and just look at them and just want to correct everybody?
I don't watch too many of those. I mean, I watch them. I watch Land Before Time with my kids and things like that, and Barney back when they were young. But Jurassic Park is the one I get asked about the most. So in 1993 when that came out, that was considered the most accurate depiction of dinosaurs. And I would argue that it's, they looked accurate back then, but our ideas have changed. Most of the meat-eating dinosaurs we know were covered with feathers and these sorts of things. My advisor at Montana State University was a very famous dinosaur paleontologist named Jack Horner, who is the model for Alan Grant in Jurassic Park. And the Jurassic Park film people came out and I showed them how to dig up a dinosaur. And I think the worst scene in that whole movie was how quickly they dug up that dinosaur. So I was rather embarrassed for my contribution to Jurassic Park.
Well, no, that's really interesting, though, that you say that it was really accurate at the time. But the study and the things, people like you have advanced our knowledge of these dinosaurs so much that is no longer would be considered as accurate as what we know.
Yeah, I mean, the most glaring thing that jumps out is the raptors have slowly gotten a little bit of feathers, but we now know that the raptors actually were covered in sort of hairy-looking feathers, kind of like what a kiwi would look like today. And they also had kind of wing-like structures on their arms, which were probably for display. So basically the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park are naked. So
yeah, They had been plucked.
And I won't make any more jokes about that.
They had been plucked. We have another call coming in from Don in Port Charlotte. Don, what would you like to ask?
I just have two quick questions, if I may. One is, what does the KT and KT barrier mean? And I heard that before the great asteroid event, there was a decline already going on because India was supposedly sliding across a continent, and as it slid, it caused tremendous amounts of disruption to the base, and they had volcanoes all over the place. Is that true? Was there a decline going on before the great asteroid event?
Okay.
Yeah, those are great questions. Let's see. What was the first one?
K2 barrier.
Oh, what is KPG? What does that mean? So the Cretaceous was the last period of in geologic time when the dinosaurs lived. And the PG stands for the Paleogene, which was the first age of mammals, essentially, or first period when the mammals existed. So it's basically a geological term. So that's what that is, and it occurred at about 65.5 million years, and those are named for differences in the rocks as well as the kinds of fossils that exist basically across those kinds of barriers. And so were the dinosaurs in decline and this idea that maybe there was lots of volcanism? So I believe it was Don who called in. You're correct. Right, just before the dinosaurs go extinct, the Deccan basalts were formed in India. So basically, two-thirds of the whole continent of India, which is a floating continent at the time, was basically just lava. There was just there was a massive volcanism that occurred. And anytime a volcano goes off, it causes huge disruptions to the climate around the world. Just a single volcano can do that. Tambora is a great example. And so one theory is that actually before we even knew it, an asteroid had hit the planet, the theory was that volcanism had disrupted the planet, maybe cooled it, these sorts of things. So that's definitely I'm not saying an asteroid alone killed the dinosaurs. Some researchers think it was a combination of the volcanism and asteroid. And then there's another factor. There used to be warm, shallow seas that went across Europe and basically split North America and split South America. And so the world was, basically had warm maritime environments around the world. And those seas also drain right at the same time those volcanoes go off, and they may be related. So some paleontologists believe that it was a combination of all three of those factors that basically led to the basically this resource limited environment at about 65.5 million years. Other people think it was just the asteroid. I don't concern myself too much with that aspect of it. I mean, the point is, as I'm really a biologist, and so it's it's undisputed basically that the ecosystems really fell apart and it was a resource limited environment. So I'm more looking at the animals and trying to understand their biology and why they did or didn't make it, and I don't concern myself as much with the cause, but it's hard to really figure out exactly what what did them in.
Well, this breakthrough that you made is definitely a contributing factor if it takes them so long to gestate and continue their species.
Yeah, so. We'd like to think it's an important piece of the puzzle. It's not the only thing. There's so many nuances that go into whether animals survive or don't after a cataclysm. But there's only so much we can get from bones and teeth.
I was going to say. We're talking about things that are 65 million years old. Is there a thing about dinosaurs that you think is yet to be discovered that we haven't stumbled upon yet?
Oh, there's all kinds of things about their, metabolic rates and, things like that, aspects of their behavior. We're actually just starting to figure out the colors of a few dinosaurs, believe it or not.
How do you figure that out?
they look at the feathered dinosaurs, and there's a protein molecule called a melanosome, and they're kind of sausage shaped. And people have discovered these in fossils from China and from Germany. And what happened was one dinosaur in particular looked like it had kind of bands, like dark bands to its feathers. And so some people looked at this under a scanning electron microscopes, and they saw these little sausage shaped molecules. And then they went and looked at modern birds and basically find these same protein structures in bird feathers. And basically the architecture of those those little sausage molecules and how they're interwoven together basically gives the reflection of light that bounces off the feathers and tells you what color they were. And so a dinosaur I co-named with some of my Chinese colleagues called Anchiornis, which is this little tiny raptor from China. It was shown to be basically looked like a roadrunner kind of thing, or more like a woodpecker. It had a black and white banding to it with a red crest on its head.
That is so fascinating. I can't believe that you can even figure that out. Just standing in awe of people that can figure these things out. It's been really a joy to get to talk with you today. I really enjoyed it. It's been very fun. But we're going to have to leave it there today because we're running out of time. But thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. Dr. Gregory Erickson, thanks so much and congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That was Dr. Gregory Erickson, professor of biological science at Florida State University. We were discussing his study of fossilized dinosaur eggs. That conversation originally aired last year. We're going to end today's show with the latest book review. Associate professor of journalism and writing at University of Tampa, John Capuya, arrived in Florida from New York, where he wrote for Newsweek, Newsday, and the New York Times. His eclectic interests range from work about yoga and wrestling to Native American Indian burial mounds. Sally Bissell reviews the results of Capuya's latest passion in his latest book, Florida Soul, from Ray Charles to Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Few people would automatically conflate the words Florida and soul, especially in light of our state's dark history of racial injustice. But the author John Capuya forces readers to rethink assumptions by taking us on a glorious tour down a musical memory lane, beginning with the remarkable life of Ray Charles Robinson, raised in Greenville by his mother and grandmother. A common denominator for many of the musicians in this book is the strong influence of the Black Church and the way that gospel music morphed into soul. But Shiloh Baptist, the Robinson family's church, was too poor for even a piano, so Ray started banging out tunes on the one in the general store. By the age of 7, he had lost his sight. By 15, he was a professional writer and performer. Percy Mayfield was leading a 14-piece band on tour with a stop in Tampa when he discovered alto sax player Ernie Calhoun, signing him up even though he was still in high school. Reminiscing from his home in Ybor City, Calhoun speaks reverently of the thriving Black music clubs in Tampa during the 40s and 50s, his years on the road that broadened his horizons, and his stint in the Army during the Korean conflict that awakened his conscience. Florida A&M University in Tallahassee was an incubator for several musicians featured in Florida Soul, including DeLand's Noble Watts, whose tenor sax earned him a place touring with Lionel Hampton and Paul Williams. Though one of his recordings made it to number 44 on the Billboard charts in 1957, the author said it was likely the honorary doctorate in music awarded to Watts by Stetson University that was his greatest achievement. In Pensacola, Capuya interviews Ben Moore, who won a Grammy Award as part of the legendary Blind Boys of Alabama and sang at the White House for President Obama. He was once known as half of the duo James and Bobby Purify. In Miami, we meet retired educator Timmy Thomas, who, trained in political nonviolence by Martin Luther King Jr., wrote and recorded the soul anthem, Why Can't We Live Together, that's recently been brought back to the forefront by Drake. Another chapter is devoted to Linda Lindell, a white woman who started belting out gospel songs at the Bethel AME Church in Gainesville when she was only 4 or 5. Though she recorded several hits, touring with a black band in the 60s brought threats and trouble. Now happily running a plant nursery outside Tallahassee, Lindell still thinks of what might have been and believes that racism derailed her career. Deeply researched, graced with gorgeous black and white photos by Suzanne Williamson, this is a fascinating 60-year history of Florida as seen through the lens of jazz, soul, and R&B musicians, producers, writers, and performers. No need to be a music scholar to appreciate this book. You simply have to love that sweet soul music.
That was Sally Bissell's review of John Capuia's Florida Soul, from Ray Charles to Casey and the Sunshine Band. You can find all of her reviews at WGCUnews.org. That's all the time we have for today's show. It was produced by Mike Kaniri. Our director is Richard Chin Kui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.
Brian Brown fled his California home when fire threatened.
A police officer pulls down there. He then yells at us, "Get out now!" And there's three helicopters right above our house, ready to drop water.
I'm Ari Shapiro. With record-setting wildfires in California, we'll ask, is there a better way to fight them? Weighing the options for fighting fires this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.
Some American sanctions on Iran are back on. Oil is next, if the U.S. can make them stick.
It is also possible for Iran to truck its oil across the border to Turkey, and that would be much harder for the U.S. to track.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Cat, meet mouse, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.